Today's Taisho will be on case 37 in the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 37 is entitled Bonzan's Three Worlds, No Dharma. Engo's Introduction. The spirit which moves like lightning, you fail to follow. When the bolt descends from the blue, you have no time to cover your ears. The scarlet banner flutters over the master's head. The two-edged sword is being brandished behind the student's neck. Unless your eyes are sharp and your hands move quickly, how can you cope with the situation? One will lower his head and ponder, following delusive ways of thoughts. Don't you know that countless skulls are haunted by ghosts? I want to ask you, without falling into the delusive way of thinking and without halting irresolutely, how can you respond to the teacher's words? See the following. Main subject. Bonzan said to his students, in the three worlds there is no dharma. Where could you find the mind? Secho's verse, three worlds, no dharma, where could you find the mind? White clouds crown the heavens. The streams draw music from the heart, tunes and harmonies which none can understand. The night's rain has brought the autumn waters deep. To thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice Zen. We had some difficult weather. It's beautiful, but I know that the roads were very icy this morning, and I'm glad you could make it. This is a wonderful way, I think, to spend the morning, and I'm very glad you could all be here. Spend it this way. I was recently asked to drive up to North Jersey because a friend of one of our members was in great distress. This person had had a number of personal setbacks, and she really didn't know how to cope with her situation. She had gone to school, to graduate school, and gotten a degree in chiropractic, and had become a licensed chiropractor. And she had built up a very successful business. She had a building where she had set up her practice, and I myself have been there. And it was a very attractive building. There were three or four tables for manipulating the body. You know, chiropractors work primarily with the spine and the back. And they do physical manipulation, like a little bit like physical therapists. And there were three or four of these tables. They're specially designed tables. You lie generally face down, And there's cushions for your forehead and for your neck. And they're adjustable, and they're really for the chiropractor to conduct therapeutic manipulation of the body. And as I say, there were four of these, so she was doing quite a bit of business. And in addition, she had other spaces in the building that she rented out to physical therapists and people who were involved with various kinds of healing, alternative medicine or healing. And I have been in there a number of times because we held meditation in her place. She was nice enough to let us use her building after hours for meditation at one time. And I would get there maybe a 6:45, and the place would still be quite busy. You know, this person was meeting the last of her clients, or saying goodbye to her clients, the last of her clients for the day. Some of the other people in the building were leaving, and it was a really bustling place. But I guess the economic downturn really hit her very hard. Because, as I learned, she had to sell her building. Apparently, a number of clients in the building weren't able to continue to rent there. Maybe their business had fallen off, and she was dependent on having clients in the building. And so at some point she reached a place where she could no longer afford to make her monthly payments. And she put the building up for sale. But, as you know, property values have plunged, right? So I didn't get all the particulars, but my impression is that this was a very difficult situation for her financially, because she wasn't able to recover all of the investment in the property when she sold it. So then a number of other difficult things happened to her in her life, all sort of in a row, you know. One of those difficult things was giving birth to her second child. And that first child had been pretty easy, but the second one was very, very difficult and complicated. And apparently, when the child came home, everything was going smoothly, but sometime early on, it stopped breathing, and it became very blue, and fortunately, she was able to call the hospital and get instructions on how to get the baby to breathe again. But as you can imagine, that it was very frightening, because she almost lost her little baby. So these things all sort of piled up on her, And I was very moved by her situation, because, you know, basically this is somebody who, you know, is, I think, a very kind person, very good person, and also somebody who's quite hardworking. You know, she actually is a Rutgers graduate, and has a lot on the ball. You know, she got out of school, and she decided she wanted to be a chiropractor in the helping professions, you know, health professions. And she went back for more schooling, and that involved a lot of work. And then she, you know, set up her own place, and was very successful. You know, she's like, get out of college, go to graduate school, started her own business. You know, everything was going very, very well, you know. And then she had all of these setbacks, you know. And I must say, it must have been very difficult for her to lose a business that she had built up over a period of years, you know. When you put that much time into something, it's very painful to see it all just fall apart. And of course, she had these other setbacks, and the most important one was the near death of her new son. Anyway, this person wanted to meet with me because she was really sort of like rocked, you know, really shaken on her foundations, you know, or off her foundations. And she is a very intelligent person, you know, so I don't think she'd mind my just saying part of what she said during the conversation. She said, you know, I know in a certain part of my mind that you know, bad things can happen to good people, you know. I know that. But in another part of my mind, I've always thought that if I was an ethical person, if I made an effort to be good and kind, and if I, you know, I've really tried hard, you know, bad things wouldn't happen to me. And she said, and yet, you know, I feel like I've been knocked down a number of times, and I think she felt that it was unfair, you know, that life was being unfair to her. Now, I think she also felt a little guilty. You know, like, what have I done wrong? Maybe I've done something wrong to deserve this, you know, which is very common. You know, I met a person, I knew a person who had an auto accident, and it was quite serious, and the person was in hospital for a while. And he came out and he told me that he felt guilty about it. It's like, if only I had, you know, looked left as I should have looked, this accident never would have happened. And it's like, come on, you know, it's an accident. But people can be very hard on themselves when misfortunes happen, you know. And so this person was a little bit, I think, hard on herself, sort of felt guilty, felt life was unfair, felt guilty, and also really hurt, you know, like her feelings were hurt by all of this. And finally, her trust was like completely gone. It was just like completely gone. And this is so common, right? Especially, I think, people in the modern world. We have a lot of good prospects, you know, like a lot of good life prospects. The whole of our society is rather generous in providing opportunities for people. This morning, I was, for some reason, I remembered my old algebra teacher in high school, in junior high. You know, I can't even remember her name right now, but when I took Algebra 1, I couldn't figure out how to do algebra. And I couldn't do algebra to save my life, you know. It was 2x plus 3y equals 36, you know. What's x? And I had no idea. How am I supposed to know, you know? And 2x plus 3y equals 36, 1x plus, you know, 7y equals 28. So what's x and what's y, you know? And I just couldn't, it just boggled my mind, you know. It was just, I got very flustered very easily, and I just was failing all these tests in algebra, and I just wanted to be taken out of algebra and put in another class so I didn't have to deal with all this stuff. And my algebra teacher wouldn't let me quit. You know, she said, you've got to learn algebra, you know, if you want to do many things in life. And she just pushed me and pushed me. And finally, I actually did very well in algebra. I wanted to quit and run away, but she wouldn't let me, you know. And I've had a number of teachers like that who actually opened doors for me even when I didn't want them to be open. And it occurred to me on various occasions that our society really tries to get a lot of doors open for people, you know. And we're sort of used to having things work for us, actually. So something like Rutgers exists so people can come to school. And probably for 100 years, people who have wanted to go to college have had ways of getting to college, you know. Even though it's challenging to get into something like pharmacy, which is very difficult, or medical school, or many other fields, you know. The doors are open, you know, a lot of the time. And so, you know, we're used to having doors open for us. I know many people who, you know, have gone from Rutgers to really good jobs. And that's the only reality they know. And this woman was sort of like that. You know, she had worked very hard, but many doors had opened for her. Many good things had happened in her life, and suddenly it was like a series of doors closed on her. And it was very, maybe because life for all of us is pretty easy, actually, it was pretty shocking. And of course, the incident with her son, that was terrifying, right? This was actually a person who... I don't think might be able to do Zazen right now. Some people are really not cut out necessarily for doing Zazen, at least to start with. And so what I recommended to this person was something else that's called Nyenfo. You know, Zen. As Zen developed in China, there were many different practices going on in any particular temple, even Rinzai temples, Linji temples. A Linji temple in China typically had a hall for Dzogchen, for Zazen, seated meditation. But it also had a hall for Nyenfo, for like a recitation. Or chanting, you could say. And some people were really very. Some people did very well with zazen, what we did this morning. But some people would do chanting. They'd go into the Nyenfo hall, and they might sit in a chair or kneel on a bench and say something like Amitabha, 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 Amitabha. And so I recommended to this person that she try Nyenfo. And I gave her a mala with 108 beads. And I said, just, you know, move one bead through your hand, and I gave her like a mantra to recite, like lines from a sutra, basically. And apparently it's going very well. I'm so happy to hear. And this is actually part of Zen tradition. When Zen went to Japan, the pure, what's called Pure Land practice, was very separate from Zen. But in China, you know, Chinese have a different spirit. They tend to be more comfortable with everything brought together. So In Zen temples in China, people practice Yen Fo and Zazen. This wasn't the case in Japan, but that's too bad because I think they can go together very well. And in this person's case, reciting these lines from a sutra that I gave her apparently has been working very well. I'm so happy. And I think that it works so well because, people have this this mind that is capable of forming mental images, this is something that animals can do too, but we can do it to an extraordinary degree, And so, if we have an event like losing a business, it's very hard for us to put that down. Very hard. And there's a part of us that wants to make it right, correct the mistake. But actually, losing your business isn't necessarily a mistake, and it's not really correctable, right? I mean, you can learn from what you did, but sometimes you did everything right and you still lost your business. I mean, it's not this person's fault that our economy has gone into a major downturn, right? Sometimes things happen to us even when we're careful. Even when we exercise good judgment, some things can happen, right? That's very difficult for us to face. In fact, I think people would rather believe that they were careless. They would rather think, I was careless. I could have corrected that. I could have. And so there's a tendency to go over these events over and over and over in your mind. If you find yourself doing this, this is very human, right? It might not be something like losing a business, but perhaps something has not gone well in your life recently, or you've made some kind of a mistake, right? And you can go over it and over it and over it. Tests are interesting, I think, because there's an element of chance in doing well, on a test. It's just a fact. Sometimes you can study, and you don't appreciate some detail that turns up on the test, right? And the truth is, you can take a test and it can ask you questions you didn't study adequately, but you could know a lot that the test didn't measure. This may seem obvious, but you could have deep knowledge and the person who designed the test just didn't decide that that was going to be on the test, So tests aren't perfect measurements of what really. They're very actually they're very arbitrary, So you could study a lot, you could work very hard, and you could take a test, but the professor could pick some detail you didn't pay enough attention to. Out of all the ones you did pay attention to, And this is going to happen sooner or later. There's no way that this isn't going to happen. It has to happen sooner or later, right? You can't know everything. And it's a human situation, right? So the professor and you are both looking at the same material, but the professor might think this is more important than that, And so you might not get the grade you expected on the test, and you might find yourself sitting there going over and over the event, and saying, why didn't I notice that? What was wrong with me? Generally flagellating yourself for your failure to think just like your professor, which is impossible anyway, right? And you may have a hard time letting that go, right? You replay it over and over in your mind. And sometimes people feel they need to punish themselves. Even people who work very hard, when things aren't going well, they sometimes feel like this is their fault and they have to push themselves even harder. And yet, you know, that's actually quite a big mistake. You know, it's very very difficult to free ourselves from this kind of reliving of events. And of course, you know, when we think about the future, we use a similar kind of intelligence, or we draw on a similar kind of imaginary imagination, you know. So for example, this woman's baby stopped breathing, and it turns out the reason it stopped breathing was that it got some mucus in its throat and it couldn't clear its throat. This happens to little babies, right? It happens, you know. You know, everybody has mucus, and this mucus got caught in the baby's throat and impaired its breathing. And when she called the hospital, they told her what to do. I've heard other stories like this about babies having obstructed breathing. It sometimes can even be caused by gas, you know, actually. Babies have gas, too. And they can turn blue because they aren't burping, you know, and that's why mothers try to burp their babies. But anyway, you know, after an event like that, it's very difficult not to imagine that it's going to happen again, right? It's like, you know, every time this person gets up in the morning, she can be thinking, my God, it might happen again. You know, and imagining like a series of events, and what if the phone hadn't been working or something like this, you know. All of this is very human, right? We have a deep desire to control circumstances, and it's very, very frightening to realize the truth, and it's the truth, right? Which is that our control over events is limited, right? It's just limited. Actually, things that are not so good can happen to wonderful people, and things that are unexpected can happen to very cautious and careful people, you know. You could be the best driver in the United States, and you could get in your car as you leave here and have an accident. This is absolutely so. You know, you could, let's say you're going to go to graduate school, you could research the programs that you've chosen, and you could research them meticulously, and you could get there and think, oh my God, what have I done? I've picked the wrong, this is a terrible place to be. This happens to people all the time, and it's not really escapable. It's not. So I think it's very important to find a way to live with this high level of uncertainty or uncontrollability in life. You know? If you don't find a way to live with this, you can let worry and fear eat you up inside, and it can affect you negatively. You know, people who are chronically fearful tend not to be open, generous, warm, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that it takes a certain kind of openness and trust to cultivate those qualities. People who have a lot of joy in life, curiosity, openness, and so on, somehow have found ways to live with, you know, these high levels of uncertainty. And I think that this Nyenfo practice that I recommended to this person was a very good idea, because Nyenfo is like is very much like watching your breath, you know. If you say you're sitting quietly and you say, ah, or it could be Namyo Renge Kyo, Namyo Renge Kyo, Namyo Renge Kyo, Namyo Renge. You know, the mind begins to enter a different state, right? And it's we call it a different state, you know. But if you stay there long enough, visualizing what the future could bring, and you stop remembering some traumatic event in your past, yeah? And you may also be quite unaware of what's happening in the present also, you know? And this state is quite wonderful. It's what we call mushin. It's really not a state of mind at all, actually, you know. It's actually not a condition of mind at all. Even though we say it's a state of mind, it's not. Have you noticed this? You know, some people come into this room on beginner's night on Monday and Wednesday, and they'll try zazen. And in some cases, people will try it and they just don't like it, and they'll never come back. And sometimes usually they don't admit that. I'll say, "How was your sit?" And they'll say, "Great." And I'll say, "Wonderful, please come back." And they say, "Okay," and then they never do. That happens. But some people really have a wonderful sit. They really have a wonderful sit. And it may last for a while. It may last for a while. In other words, they may come back and have another great sit. But eventually they stop having great sits. Have you ever wondered why that is? It's because they discover something on the cushion that's like an opening, or it's like a liberation, really. But then they form a expectation about it, and they form a mental image or an idea, and they hold tightly onto that mental image or that idea. And of course, the more tightly they hold, the farther they are from what they originally experienced. Mm-hmm. So they create a kind of mental state. But what we do when we sit on the cushion is really not to enter a mental state at all. That blank, we say blank mind, really isn't mind. It really isn't. If you keep practicing, you'll see what I mean. It really has no characteristics at all. We say shunyata, fundamentally empty. What we call mind really is, really begins when that emptiness is concealed, you could say. So people conceal that emptiness. They come in, they sit down on the cushion, they've never done zazen before, they don't know what to expect, and they have this beautiful experience of being set free from this cycle of thinking, right? And that's a wonderful experience. And then they hold on to that, they form a mental image of that experience, and they hold on to it. And next time they keep trying to return to the idea of freedom, the idea of opening, but it's not the same. And after a while, they feel like they've lost touch with something. One person I know who's been practicing meditation for a long time, maybe 4 or 5 years, recently wrote me and said that he was getting discouraged because he would go to Sesshin and have this wonderful experience of opening, but when he would sit on the cushion in his daily practice, his mind was like distracted by 1,000 different thoughts. And this person was so discouraged. You know, he said, you know, I go to Sesshin and I reach a point where I feel so open and liberated. And then I come back and I just can't get to that place in my daily practice. I just can't get there. I try and I try. That peace and that stillness elude me. I can't get there. And he said, I'm becoming very discouraged. You know, I don't think I'll ever wake up. I don't think I'll ever have like an enlightenment experience. And, when I heard that, I was sorry that he didn't see what was happening. Because, of course, when he was at Sesshin, he was sitting for, 8 hours a day, doing meditation for 8 hours a day, and at some point his mind really was becoming shunyata, really. You know, shunyata is like the ground of everything. And if you watch your breath long enough, or you focus on your koan, sooner or later your mind is going to return to, your mind is going to disappear. And you will enter shunyata. And it's a wonderful experience, right? It's happened probably to everybody here. My friend, who was unhappy about his practice, had formed a mental image of a stillness and peace. And he remembered like day 4 of Sesshin. He could remember coming into the Dokusan room and feeling so good, right? And now when he sits at home on his cushion, he wants to have that experience come back, but of course, that's just an idea. That's just a state of mind, you know. So he's created an obstacle for himself, and I have to think about how I can help him maybe let go of his clinging to a particular state of mind, particular, you know, when you sit, when you do a lot of meditation, you will have beautiful experiences, right? Beautiful. Last night and today, I just had beautiful sits. But if you hold on to those and you try to return to them, you just create obstacles for yourself. You create a lot of unhappiness for yourself, as a matter of fact. Discontent. It's very important to just sit down on the cushion and try to have no expectations, right? And try to just focus on the breath, have no expectations, and the mind's naturally going to become empty. It's just going to happen if you stay there long enough. This morning I was watching, I open my eyes sometimes and I look at people sitting, and I saw a number of people just sitting so deeply, unmoving for an hour and a half. And that requires very deep concentration. People, I'm sure at various points in that hour and a half, their minds were disappearing into shunyata. It's not necessarily continuous, you know. It's not necessarily continuous. But you have moments where everything goes away. And then things return, and then everything goes away, and things return, and pretty soon an hour and a half has gone like that. And these people weren't moving like a muscle, not even like a muscle of their face was moving. That person is in deep, that person has moved beyond, you could say, beyond states of mind into shunyata. So really exciting to see that. If you form an image of that, however, you create another obstacle for yourself. Maybe, this is just something we have to go through over and over again, you know. A lot of Zen practice is just like exhausting the hungry mind, you know. People come to sesshin with all kinds of expectations, right? You know, people think, I'm going to have enlightenment, I'm going to have this kind of experience, I'm going to have that kind of experience. And you sit down on the cushion, and many of the things that happen are not what you expected, and in fact they're uncontrollable, right? You can't really control anything. That's the truth. It's frightening, but it's the truth. You can sit down on the cushion, and you could get in the right posture, and you could have had the perfect amount of sleep. You could have had like just the right amount of food. And what happens on the cushion is uncontrollable. You know, your mind is going somewhere, and it's not where you expected. And you want to go somewhere else. You know, so this is sort of what it means to do zazen a lot of the time. And you think, this is not what I wanted to have happen, you know. But you keep coming back to your breath, or you keep coming back to mu, and you're in this state of mind, and 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 at some point you exhaust all of these different states of mind, you know, all the dreams, all the fear, anger. And this is what we call purifying body, mind, and heart. You know, there's actually different layers to what we call mind, you know. And each of them has a tendency to get stuck, or to develop what you could call energy habits. So there's a form of awareness which is associated with seeing. We think of seeing as a kind of experience, right? You see, but actually seeing is also a kind of awareness. It's a kind of mind, seeing mind. You know? Hearing is a kind of awareness. Tasting is a kind of awareness. So you have seeing awareness, hearing awareness, tasting awareness, touching awareness, smelling awareness. You have discriminating awareness, right? And you have also self-awareness. And finally, you have memory. Yeah, these are eight threads that just get woven together to make the moment of consciousness. You know. There's a seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness, tasting consciousness, touch consciousness, smell, discriminating mind, self-awareness, and memory. And each moment of awareness, each moment of mind is like these threads are getting woven together, like making a piece of cloth, right? Which is what we call reality. And each form of awareness has like karma, You know, has like these, you get stuck with these energy habits. So for example, if you, I myself like very spicy food, you know. I've gotten into Indian food in a big way. And I have like a bag of chili peppers in my kitchen, and sometimes I'll just take two or three of these peppers and break them up in my hand and put them on anything I'm eating, even rice, you know? And I like that sensation of very, very spicy. And so I've noticed lately that when I eat rice without chili peppers, it seems very tasteless and bland. See, this is I've created an energy habit. Like even the seeing has a kind of karma. Even seeing has a kind of karma. Right? You know, if you go into the Metropolitan Museum in New York and you spend the day in the gallery, you can look at all these beautiful paintings by great artists like Matisse and Renoir, Cézanne, and you can spend the whole day just staring at these, you know, these incredible mountains, gold and blue, and maybe you look at Gauguin's painting of women with a golden skin, and the apples are green and red, and then you step out of the building and you look around New York and it all just seems gray, see? That's it's karma. You created an energy habit, you know? Created a state of mind. Yeah. And so all of these different forms of awareness are like creating, all the time we're creating energy habits with our different forms of consciousness as we weave and unweave them. And those energy habits get in the way, really, of being in the moment, just being in the pure simplicity of the moment. We never, or we very rarely encounter the moment with like a neutral mind, impartial mind. Everything, sight, hearing, taste, touch, self-awareness, all of these come with energy habits formed. But you know, if you sit on the cushion long enough and you watch your breath or you call mu, little by little, these are all like a smoothed out or exhausted, you know, or cleared away. And every once in a while, it becomes possible to enter like shunyata, like blank mind. And then, you know, when you, after going deeply into blank mind, when you become aware, it's like having a dirty window that you've just washed clean, you know? Like a dirty window, and now you've washed clean, and when you look out the window, you can just see everything you couldn't notice before when it was dirty. And this is what Zen is all about, really. This is really what Zen is all about. If you can do this, you know, if you can do this, you can handle anything. You can handle absolutely anything. You know, I promise. You know, my friend who had these setbacks, you know, is working with Nyenfo, and when she calls I gave her particular lines from a sutra which I'd rather not talk about. But when she goes through this recitation over and over in her mind, she enters a state of shunyata, blank mind. And then, you know, it's possible to move through the world without fear and anxiety, tension, and so on. And hopefully this member of our group will find a way out of his predicament. I have to think about what to recommend, you know, because when you are expecting bliss on the cushion, you're guaranteeing that you will not have bliss on the cushion, you know. I talked about this at Sesshin, but Rinzai, Master Linji, had a wonderful, used to talk sometimes about a creature, a marvelous creature named, called a Hamsa. Ahamsa in Indian thinking, it comes from ancient Indian thinking. Hamsa is a kind of goose or swan. It's like a magical goose or swan. Sarasvati rides a Hamsa, a goddess of, like you could say, knowledge, rides a Hamsa. And for ancient people in India and China, the Hamsa was really remarkable, you know, because it's a special kind of animal. It can walk on the land, it can dive into the sea, and it can fly up into the sky, see? So wherever it can, it's at home wherever it goes, you know? And in ancient times, like in the Vedic times, the Hamsa could fly up to Surya, up to the sun. And so the Hamsa is like a mythical bird, but there really are birds called Hamsa. They're like a goose or a swan, sort of combination. And Lin Chi used to talk about, he said, you know, you can be like a Hamsa. In Chinese thinking, the Hamsa is like a magical bird because, you know, it has this power to, if you took some milk and you had a beautiful bowl of fresh milk, nourishing and delicious, that would be wonderful, right? But somebody might come along and put a poison in the milk, yeah? Poison in the milk, that would be a terrible thing. And in a way, you know, life is often like that poisoned milk, you know? Life is beautiful and wonderful, but because we can't free ourselves from our expectations and fears, everything is like poisoned, yeah? The Hamsa is like a magical bird because it can lean down into the milk with its beak, see, and it can drink the milk but leave the poison behind in the bowl. See, and Lin Chi says, you know, if you practice Zen, you'll be like the Hamsa, right? The world is really beautiful. Things are not going to go the way we planned. You can count on it. And you can either be ill and unhappy, or you can have like incredible happiness and joy. It's possible to have incredible happiness. Every moment is so alive and so perfect. But because we form a mind which we call our mind, you know, even though our mind is never the same, you know, we keep maintaining this illusion that we have a mind which is our mind. And we live in fear, and we live in anxiety, and so on and so on. But it doesn't have to be this way. You know, and you can be a Hamsa, right? No matter what life hands you, you can go through it without any you can thrive in the midst of adversity, which is really what life is all about, you know. The secret is a shunyata, shunyata. So everybody came here today to practice Zen. And what happened on the cushion was probably not what you planned, right? But if you stay on the cushion long enough, you exhaust all your expectations, all your mental images, and you fall into something much deeper. And if you stay there long enough, everything is quite pure and beautiful when you get off the cushion. So I hope you had a little taste of that today. And if you didn't, please have no opinion, you know. Just go on with your practice, and sooner or later that will happen. It'll be wonderful for you. Banzan said to his students, "In the three worlds, past, present, and future, there is no Dharma. There is really actually nothing called mind. Where could you find it?" Secho's verse, three worlds, no Dharma. Where could you find the mind? White clouds crown the heavens, The streams draw music from the harp, tunes and harmonies which none can understand. The night's rain has brought the autumn waters deep. It's a beautiful world, beautiful world. Every time it troubles us, it's just another fantasy, right, that we've formed. And if we sweep them away, everything becomes really precious. So thank you for coming today. Please continue to practice this beautiful path.